Alcoholic, my name's Keith.
Hi.
By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, room full of people like you and a little effort on my own, I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since May 11th, 1976, and for that I'm a good to be here, good to be sober. I want to thank Ben for inviting me. Ed, I was here in 81 or 82. I know I was 50 pounds lighter. And I had hair. So I guess, you know, that was good. I haven't drank since then, so it worked. Yeah, and it's good, good. And it's good to be an anniversary. Good to see people I know and some of my friends from down south where I live and, you know, people that I've met on this journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. What a fantastic journey it's been. Always amazed. If you're new or relatively new, why stick around and see what happens. You'll be absolutely amazed. And I couldn't have predicted my life anyway whatsoever, what it's been. And my sobriety is worse than a lot of people's drunkalogs, so, you know. And immediately drop in and zip up, you know. But I'm grateful for that. It would have been boring otherwise. And I'm fortunate. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a family, and my family stayed with me. I'm still married. I've been with my wife 41 years. I know there's a lot of painful relationships go on in AA, but staying with somebody for 41 years ain't easy either. And I have a 38-year-old daughter, and I have a 2.5-year-old granddaughter, so I'm a grandpa. You know, that'll happen to you. Yeah. And I'm grateful for that. I share that with you. I'm 61 years old and retired, and there's still some firsts. See? There's still some firsts. That's a neat thing about it. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought it was all over. I had no idea. I thought I'd done it all. I'd had it all, been there, done that, all those things. And the fantastic thing about Alcoholics Anonymous and this way of life is that there's still firsts. I still get to experience a lot of fantastic things, things that I would have missed had I not come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I had my first drink, an alcoholic was born. And I come from a long line of alcoholics. It's not necessary to do that, but I am. One thing about growing up in an alcoholic home is there's booze. It's handy. And there's neurotic, insane people around everywhere. And I got out of there alive. I survived. And I ended up 36 years old in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in a room full of selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, insane people. And you said, "Welcome, you're home." And I can assure you some of the tools that I learned to survive within my own family have been very, very necessary right here in AA. Yeah. And I'm grateful for that. I was born in Texas, and that doesn't make you an alcoholic. It's actually a disease of its own. Actually, I grew up in the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle where the men are men and the sheep run scared. I mean, the Baptists bought all the liquor licenses and, you know, we drank, you know, homebrew and, you know, White Lightning and, you know, things like that. And, you know, it was just... You know, you're on your own, and I grew up like that. My granddad was an alcoholic, and his dad was an alcoholic. My dad's an alcoholic. My dad's a lawyer, and I've never resented that. I kept him on retainer for years. He sobered up when he's 62 years old, and he's still alive. He's 86, and he just had 24 years of sobriety. And I have about 14 months of seniority on him. I don't ever let him forget it. My dad still lives back there in the Texas-Oklahoma Panhandle. They have a meeting on Monday night, and I've been back there and gone to this meeting. They have it in the 4-H Club building, and he's the secretary. And the old man, he still works, and I I go with him, and he goes, you know, at 7:45, well, he'll get up and shuffle across the room and go, come on, we're going, and go out and get, and he's got a Cadillac, great big old long Cadillac, and drives down there and pulls up in front of that big 4-H building, and go in there, and, you know, great big old round table, and he shuffles over and gets this 30-cup pot and starts putting coffee in it, making coffee, you know, and I just sit down and watch him. It's his meeting, you know, and I go over there, and pretty soon he'll set the coffee up. I said, you get that many people here? He said, well, you never know. You know, might just be me and you. And throws the literature out on the deal, you know, and I was there not long ago, and along about 8:15, while the door bursts open, in comes this little cowboy, about 5'2", got a great big hat on, and his pants are stuck in his boots, and he comes in, and he looks mean. He said, I'm Angry John. Do you want to talk about God? You know, well, whatever. He says, God's my horse. I said, oh? He said, yep. He said, I ain't drank in 18 years, and every morning I go out and ask my horse, should I drink? And my horse has never told me to drink. Well, he said, your dad's my sponsor. And he sat down, and, you know, okay, now what, you know? Pretty soon the door opens up, and here comes all these convicts in, because the penitentiaries are full, so they send all the alcoholics out to these small community jails and give them $40 a day or something, whatever, to go around and pick up the trash. They got a big sign on their back, convict, you know, and they're all about 26, you know, hip, slick, and cool, dope fiends. They come trucking in, you know, and Bonnaroo, and sit down, you know, and John says, you want to talk about God? And they, no. You want to talk about dope? And John says, I don't know nothing about dope. My dad says, I don't know nothing about dope. And I say, I know a little about dope. So we sit there and talk about all this different stuff for about 2.5 hours, you know, and they never read nothing. They never had a format. They never had a procedure. They never did nothing. We just talked. Pretty soon the convicts recognize they're late being back to jail, so they get up and leave. And pretty soon John jumps up and said, I got to go put my horse to bed. And he leaves, and as he gets to the door, he yells back at my dad and says, you think we ought to keep this meeting open another week? And my dad says, oh, yeah, well, let's do it. We'll be here next week. And we close it up, go home, you know. And, you know, I don't have the heart to tell them they're doing it wrong. I mean, I'm from California, where you read all kinds of stuff and do all kinds of, have procedures and rules, man. And I don't know, they just seem to be staying sober out there for some reason. You know, probably because the horse ain't told them to drink yet. Anyway, I was in trouble early on. Alcohol was a part of my life when I was 12 years old. I got in trouble, and they locked me up and with a bunch of other kids just like me, and I learned some new things, and by the time I got out of there, it was equivalent to a senior in high school, and I had some new ideas and new rules, and, you know, somewhere around 16, 17 years old, I met and married a young lady whose father was one of the 10 richest men in the United States, and I'm a quick study, and I saw that one, and that marriage only lasted 9 months because her father said, call me in and said, you know, I've got a lot of money. And I said, I've noticed that. And he said, well, I didn't get this money making bad investments, and you're a bad investment. And I got busted for transporting some non-habit-forming marijuana. I wasn't smoking it. I was selling it. And so the state of Texas frowned on that, and they put me away for a period of 3 to 5 years, and you know, no big deal, and I went into that institution like any other institution, and I didn't go to AA or anything else, you know, when I was in the rodeo down at Huntsville. That's about the best I can say. And, you know, did my time, got out, and went home, and wanted everybody to know I was back home, because I always go home. I went home up where I lived on Wolf Creek. They had Saturday night dance down on Wolf Creek, and nobody you know, cared what happened, and I went in there at midnight and started to fight, and the fight got out of hand, so I ducked into the woman's restroom. There was a lady standing there, and I said, tell me when the fight's over, and I went in and hid in one of the stalls, and pretty soon she came in and said, you can come out now, the band's playing and the fight's over. And I went out and she was handy and I asked her to dance and I've been together ever since. Because I found out she had a job and a car and a driver's license and a place to stay, see, and none of which did I have, see. I said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. She said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. I said, well, I just got out of the penitentiary. She said, well, I just got out of an unwed mother's home. I said, well, hell, we deserve each other. We did, too. I said, stick with me, baby, and I'll take you places you've never been before. Mm-hmm. I did, too. Most of them, she didn't want to go, but hell, I took her anyway. We started a little light romance, and we dated for 2 weeks, and they nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. It was a violent, violent relationship, very physically violent. And, you know, we beat the hell out of each other and called it foreplay is really what we did. Passion. I'm violent. I'm a physically violent person. You know, I won't debate with anybody whether verbal abuse is worse than physical abuse because I was talking to you when I was hitting your ass. I give them that. Anyway, we got married because she said she was pregnant and I was the father, and I don't remember that. I was crossing over the invisible line when that happened. So we got married. Her mother was a cop. Yeah, I mean, my picker's broken, man. I mean, you can line 10 women against the wall and I'll get the sickest one every time, right? And, you know, I mean, it's just like it was just insane from the get-go. And one time she was going to commit suicide and so she cut her wrist, you know, and not very bad, just a light suicidal tendency there, you know, where you have to kind of milk it to get it to bleed over a white tablecloth. And I got a pot of chili and a case of beer and pulled up a chair, watched her, and her mother came by and said, what's going on? And I said, well, she's going to commit suicide. It's probably going to take her a while. Might as well have a bowl of chili and a beer, you know. And her mother said something, so me and her beat the hell out of her mother and threw her out of the car. Went in and made love, you know. But after a while, I got in a little trouble. That'll happen to you if you keep doing what I was doing. And my very best friend, a guy named Lion Shorty, told me I could get a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach. And I didn't have sense enough to know that was ocean. But a guy named Lion Shorty wouldn't lie to you, would he? So I loaded up my wife and kid and 120-pound German Shepherd dog and a cat and my station wagon, put the seats down the back, packed everything in an old trailer, and left in the middle of the night. And in AA, when a drunk packs up his family and leaves like that, they call it a geographic, but Texas called it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Time to go, and I knew it. Loaded everybody up. I got all my supply and took off, and took us a month to get to California. Most people would do it about 3 days, but I was lost a lot. We finally got there where the dog was crazy. He'd stand behind me and drill all over the back of my neck. When a truck would go by, he'd chase him to the back and run his head into the back window of the station wagon, fall on the cat, and they'd have a dog and cat fight on top of the kid, and the kid started bawling, she'd start bitching, and I'd just take a drink one day at a time. When I got to AA, they said, we'd do it one day at a time. I thought, hell, that ain't too different. I used to live like there was no tomorrow. What's this? We got to California, got a drunken uncle got me a deal on a house where nobody lived over there, and I moved right in there, you know, a bunch of hippies on one side and a motorcycle gang on the other side. I was bandito bad, I knew that, you know, moved right in there and got a deal on the thing and set up a little housekeeping, you know, and them hippies, I never seen nothing like that though out there in Texas. They was dropping that acid and taking their clothes off, laying in the front yard naked. Weird bunch. I went over and took some of that stuff and went to see 2001, you know. And, you know, hung around with the other trash, you know. And then I'd go off and do my thing, and you know, I'd be gone for a while, and then I'd come home, and I always brought people home with me that didn't want to go home and fight with their wives, so they'd come on over and watch me fight with mine, you know. My wife started carrying this 12-inch butcher knife. She took up his knife, waving his knife around. I went home one time, passed out on her 15 minutes into a two-hour conversation. They don't like that. She stabbed me all over my back, and when I came to the next morning, my old T-shirt stuck to my back, and I said, God, what's wrong with my back? She said, oh, you must have broke out of acne of the back. Drinking that rot gut whiskey, and she peeled that old shirt off me and then poured rubbing alcohol all over me. That got me closer to Jesus than anything them Baptists did. So we'd have them crazy fights. She'd stick that knife right in my stomach, and I'd stick my gun right on the end of her nose, and she'd say, you go first. I said, you're crazy. If I shoot you, you'll die. She said, I know, but when a bullet hits me, it'll knock me back, and the knife will go forward, and you'll die too. Let me tell you guys something. Sick women don't need to train for that. They know it right up front. Yeah. You know. I found myself standing in front of a judge, and the judge talking to me about me, and he had the right guy, and I couldn't remember what I was in there for because I ate my booking slip. Anyway, so, you know, 3 to 5, bang, you know, and I was out there, you know, chained up with the rest of them dudes, and some AA guy come along whipping out, you know, brochures. I didn't know what it was, but I took one, and when that guy said 3 to 5, well, I whipped that brochure out and said, I'll go to AA. You know, alcoholics right in a moment, you know, bam, how about that? I didn't know what AA was. Hell, I'd been doing B&B myself, you know. But I didn't have a Bible handy, so that's all I could get, you know. Just happened that that guy was named Phil Petty, and he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was a judge over there, and he was just starting the court card things. And unbeknownst to me, why, he said, well, hey, we'll set you right up with AA. And so they had this guy come and get me and, you know, tell me about AA. I'd been in a fight a couple of days before that and got hit upside the head with a crescent wrench and had a big bandage on my head and my, you know, them bloody earmuffs. And the old AA guy got me and took me home. I laid down on a couch, and my wife had been to see a new lawyer, and he told her maybe I should go to AA, and that was a new answer for her. So she come whipping in the house and said, I got a new lawyer, and he said you should go to AA, and I let her think it was her idea. And I didn't tell her I had a court card. So, you know, I laid there on the couch, and she said, well, you know, there's AA meeting around here somewhere. I said, yeah, he told me where it was over here in the church, And I'm stuck to the couch, and she come over there and said, what time does the meeting start? I said, I think it's at 8:30 to 10. And so at 8 o'clock, she whipped that butcher knife in my face and said, get up. And cops had taken all my guns away, so I couldn't defend myself. And she peeled me off the couch. And at that time in my good living, my house was painted 4 different colors because I lost interest easy. There wasn't a door jamb in my house that wasn't split wide open. Windows were busted. There was a Corvair and an Edsel parked in the front yard. Antiques, you know. Our family wagon was one of them baby poop brown Pintos. They only made them 1 year, kind of a baby poop brown looking thing. No reverse. Hole in the muffler, you know. And you had to drive up through the hippies' driveway, across their yard, into our driveway, to park it so you could take off. And the driver's window didn't go up but halfway or down halfway, whichever way you want to call it. And the dog would chase us. The only way you could get the dog in the old wagon was to stop. There was a Dairy Cream about a block away, and we'd always stop there and buy the dog a nickel cup of ice cream, and he'd get in the wagon. Otherwise, if he's going very far, he'd run and chase you until his legs got real short. Then he'd eat that ice cream, lick the window, so the inside of that wagon, the cat hair everywhere and dog lick, and it looked like there had been a hog slaughter in there. And the Pinto had a slight lisp to it. And my wife back then had these hairdos, you know, can and a half of spray net. I lit a cigar next to her one time. She turned blue, just went, poof. My God, she's on fire. Let's throw a coat over. But that'd hang out that window, you know, and so she peeled me off the couch, got me out in that old Pinto. The dog had chewed all the hair, all of his body, everywhere his mouth had reached. He looked like a hyena, and the cat had a permanent puff tail. The kid looked like a wounded animal, and we got in that old Pinto and headed for the first AA meeting. We pulled up in front of a church, one door in, one door out, same door, had a big AA sign out there. She pulled right up by there. I looked in that room, and I thought, man, ain't nobody in there I'd even drink with, much less sell dope to. And My wife must have sensed my approach avoidance, and she whipped that butcher knife in my face and said, "What time's the meeting over?" I said, "It's over 10. She said, "I'm going to tell you something, Ace. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you." "Well, you can keep me in AA meeting. You got a crazy woman circling the perimeter. I won't leave. I may be sick, but I ain't stupid." Yeah, that's got to be low bottom snobbery when I, you know, my life's like that, and I'm thinking if my friends see me, they'll never have nothing to do with me, you know. But I went in there and I went to one meeting a week for 4 months and never drank or used nothing. I'd go home and lay in the house all week long and go back to that meeting. I never asked anybody for a phone number. Nobody gave me a phone number. Nobody, you know, they could tell I had a sponsor. She's waiting right out there in the pinto. That's the dry as a fire hazard, man. I mean, I just, you know, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know. Nobody talked to me, nothing. You know, I wasn't causing no disturbance or nothing. I just doing my time. And I did it, and at the end of 4 months, well, I beat the deal at the courthouse, and sitting in my house, and, you know, the old dog's laying next to me, and the kid's in there, and the cat's on my lap, and she's in the kitchen. I'm back in the big bedroom, and I thought to myself, "Self, you have prematurely gone to AA. I mean, I know I'll be there someday, but I'll be old like Ed, and it'll all be over, you know what I mean?" So I resigned from AA. An amazing thing happened to me when I resigned from AA. I got struck drunk immediately. I mean, I got drunk right away because I wanted to drink, and I did. And for the next 4 years, I was drunk and sober and in and out of AA, more out than in. You know, I'd go to meetings sober and coffee break, get up and go drink a pint. Come back, sit down. Sometimes I'd come drunk, drink the coffee, and sober up. Came out of a blackout in an AA meeting one time. That's scary because you don't know who brought you. You're afraid to get up and leave. You don't know what's going to follow you out. Yeah. Went to one of them alcathons where they have them AA meetings 24/7, man. I went in there. I got drunk and sober 4 times in one day, right now. You know, AA won't keep you sober if you want to keep drinking. I never heard nothing. I never got a phone number, nothing. I remember one old fool said, "We won't guarantee you after tonight you've had your last drink, but we'll guarantee you after tonight you'll never enjoy another one." I remember him. I went back drunk on Tuesday and tried to find him. But my life changed. It changed. It never gets better. It always gets worse. Always. And then it gets worser. I know what it's like to stand in my kitchen and look down the hallway and I'm sucking on a bottle of vodka. Little 9-10-year-old girl stands at the end of the hallway looking at me suck on that bottle, and she didn't run down and grab me by the leg and say, "Daddy, come play with me." She's watching me take a drink out of that bottle. And I got to have a drink, you see. I got to have a drink because I got a phenomenon of craving. And I don't have to have a drink because I'm ashamed of what we're doing. Hell, we're way past shame. Way past shame. See? And when I look back, she's gone. She just wants to know what direction I'm going so she can go the other way. See? I know what it's like to stand in my bathroom and I'm putting that stuff in me, looking in the mirror, and I turn around and look in the mirror, and there's a little 10-and-a-half-year-old girl looking through a hole in the door in the bathroom where I stuck my foot or my fist, who knows. And just for a second, just a moment in time, her eyes catch mine. And she didn't say, "Daddy, what are you doing? Come play with me." She didn't say, "Please don't beat me and Mommy." She's looking at me, and I'm looking at me in that mirror, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that what I'm putting in me's got me. I don't have it. Ain't no way I got it. It's got my life. And there's something screaming 2 inches behind my belly button. It's screaming, screaming, screaming. I don't want to be this way. You see, I believe the definition of an alcoholic is a drunk with a conscience. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that what I was doing was wrong. I knew I was wrong. But I didn't know what to do about it. I had no idea the phenomenon of craving and how it controlled me. And I turned around and put that stuff in me and looked back and she'd be gone. I remember one day I needed a drink so bad I'm crawling down the hallway and I'm on my hands and my knees and I crawl into my daughter's room and I reach under her bed and pull her piggy bank out and I bust that piggy bank. Because that's the only money in the house. A big-time Charlie like me, a big slick. And I'm separating the pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters because I ain't going to be showing no copper. When I go to the connections house or the liquor store, I'm going to be showing silver all the way. You bet. We got eyes in the back of our head when we're doing those kind of things. And I look over my shoulder and a 10-and-a-half, 11-year-old girl's hiding in the closet watching me steal her money. And being the very best father I could be, I let her shoot out behind me without inflicting any more pain in her life. And we lived like that, not a day or a week or a month. We lived like that for the next 4 years. Because her and her mother had no idea what to do. They didn't know they could leave. They had no idea they were trapped. Trapped in the disease of alcoholism, just like I was. I had no idea what to do. Because I'd been to AA, and it didn't work. And I'd prayed. I'd been baptized and sprinkled and dipped and screwed, blued, and tattooed, and it didn't work. You know? And when you give up like that, why, you just give up. I had one last little deal going, and I hooked up this deal. I was supposed to run some stuff up the coast and make a little money, and I owed some people a lot of money. And hooked this deal up, got about $250,000 worth of coke, and got me a fifth of whiskey, and loaded that stuff up and headed up the coast, and I got up there about Santa Maria. And I drank about a half fifth of whiskey, and I had a good idea. I thought, you know, maybe I ought to hide this coke. A little ace in the hole, you know. So I pulled in land in there, and I dumped that stuff, and I drank the rest of that whiskey and forgot where I hid it. That's how I know I'm an alcoholic, not an addict. Well, I did come to and remembered I'd done something real bad. So I went over to Taft, California. Anybody ever been to Taft? There is one back there. One. The world's got an asshole, it's Taft. Yeah. Good place to hide. Good place to hide. I went over there and got a room over there in an old barracks, $50 a year. It was January 1976, and I got me a room over there and hid out. And I tried to stay loaded and, with, you know, whatever I could do, hid out. And, you know, I couldn't die. I wasn't living. I couldn't get drunk. I couldn't get sober. Just a period of time went by in my life. And, I don't even remember most of it, but I remember somewhere about the 5th, 6th of May why I sobered up enough to know that this ain't cutting it. And I pulled out of there and went back home one more time. And I went back down and went back to AA. Because if you don't die, you got to go back to AA. That happened. I had to go back to AA. And I called up Alcoholics Anonymous to a series of events. Little gray-headed man came and did a 12-step call on me. His name's Jack Callahan. He's still alive. I call him every Tuesday at 5 o'clock. And little Jack always asks me where I'm speaking next. And like last Tuesday, I told him I'm coming here. And he always tells me to tell you folks that I wouldn't have nothing to say if it weren't for him. I love that guy. He's seen me at my best. Every time I call him, that little sucker always reminds me how slick I was on May the 10th. See? And he came and got me and put me in a detox. A detox. Something I'd never done. See, I've been in nut wards, jailhouses, penitentiaries, psych wards, all kinds of places, and tried Zen Buddhism, but I was doing coke, so I didn't really, you know, get naked and hum. You know. But I'd never detox. Everybody, every time if I'd lie, they'd treat me for lying. If I stole, they'd treat me for stealing. See? If I cheated, they'd treat me for cheating. See? I didn't know. See, I remember I'd go to them AA meetings, and I'd go to them AA meetings, and I'd hear all the good stuff, and I'd go home, and I'd tell my wife, I heard all this good stuff over at AA meeting, that we ain't going to fight no more. And she'd say something about she needed some money, and we'd have a big fight, and I'd be drunk. Yeah, I'd go to an AA, sober up, go back to an AA meeting, and go over there and honk and sniff on the girls and snort around in there and see some of them sober gals, and I'd go home and tell my wife, get in the bedroom, I'm horny. And she'd say, I ain't gonna have nothing to do with you. You haven't done nothing but rape me for years. And we'd have a big fight over who was whose lore companionship. And I'd be down Long Beach with a hooker, drunk. See? I'd sober up and come back to AA, you know, and I got to handle this money deal, you know. And I'm the kind of guy who puts $100 in 8 banks and, you know, writes $8,000 worth of checks. So we have a discussion about money, and I write her a hot check. And then I have a big fight, and I'm drunk again, see? Because nothing was changing at home. See, I would go to AA and I'd hear the good stuff, but nothing was changing at home. See, and the same me will always drink again. See, and going back in that old environment where I drank, I can't stay sober in that environment. And I go back into that environment where she was crazy, she wasn't doing nothing about herself, and it's just same old pattern, same old game, and I'd be drunk again. And this little guy come, he told my wife, he said, I've seen him around before, and he needs help. We're going to put him in a detox and detox him. And you need help. And so I went over there, and they locked me up in this place. And they detoxed me. They didn't give me no pills or no nothing. They gave me a banana. Said, you need potassium. And there was 39 of us started that journey, and the first wave in that particular detox, and they detoxed me. And 11 days sober, I kicked again. And man, I'll tell you what, I'll never have to walk through that stuff again. And I just crazy. And they brought my wife in, and my daughter, and they asked my daughter, what do you think of your dad? And she said, I hate his guts. And my wife said, I'm glad you're hearing that sober. I've been trying to tell you that for years. And they looked at my daughter and said, what do you think of your mother? And she said, I hate her guts too. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that her and I were destroying this thing. And she heard it too. And I had to stay in there a couple of months, and then had to get a sponsor. I didn't know what a sponsor was. You know, I knew the word, but I didn't have a clue what it was. I thought maybe it was a friend or a buddy or something, you know. And brought this old guy who come in on H&I panel. His name is Ron. They call him Rotten Ron. And, the guy's still in my life. Sits right next to me every Thursday night. I love that guy, man. And 32 years sober. And Rotten Ron came in there, and they assigned me to be him. He said he drew straws with all the other H&I guys, and he lost. He came and got me an old van, had a bunch of those old milk crates in the back of it. Said, grab a crate and hang on. Loaded a bunch of us newcomers up and took me over there and pulled up in front of my house. And he said, I'll drop you off here and I'll be back at 8 to pick you up. And go in there and don't say nothing to her. And I said, well, if I don't say nothing to her, who's going to say something to her? He said, I don't know, but it ain't going to be you. And I went up and knocked on the door, and she come to the door. I said, I got to go to AA every day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do? She said, I went to Al-Anon, the kid's gone to Alley Teen, and the dog's gone to Alley Dog, and the cat's gone to Alley Cat. I just went in and sat down. Pretty soon, here he come, got me. I was just crazy. I didn't just sober up and everything was wonderful. I mean, I had problems. I had that stuff hid. I owed $250,000 to people. You can't write them a letter and say, I'll send you $100 a month. If you sit next to me and I give what I deserve, it's going to splatter on your ass, I'll tell you. There's people after me. And, there was a guy over in Whittier that wanted to kill me, and I kept telling Ron, this guy in Whittier wants to kill me. If he ever sees me with you, he'll blow us all up. And he said, you go over there and make a man to him. I'm tired of listening to that crap. I said, you got to be kidding me. He's going to kill me. He said, oh, you get over there and make amends to him. And I got up and went over there and knocked on that guy's door. He comes to the door all coked out and gun in both hands. He says, what are you doing here? I said, I'm in AA. It's going to be okay. Scared him to death, you know. Jeez. I ran like hell back to my old truck and went back over there to Anaheim Alano Club and whipped in there and sat next to Ron. He said, I thought I told you to go to AA over there and take care of that. I said, I did. He said, you did? I said, yeah. He said, and he didn't kill you? I said, no. He said, well, I'll be damned. I said, maybe I'll try that. Then I figured it out. That's the way they figure it out. They send you over there. You knew. They send you out there to do that. If it works, they try it. Yeah. Yeah. 52 days sober, I remember where they hid that dope. Right in the middle of a meeting. Stood right up. Whoa, hey. I didn't ask my sponsor, you want to go for a ride? I didn't ask somebody if we ought to flush it. I went and got it. Called him up. Said, I got the stuff. Remember where it was. Meet me. And I met him in Ventura. Gave it back to him. And I said, I'm going to AA. I didn't know. That's true. And they said, don't call us. We'll call you. And I walked back across that parking lot. And I figured they're going to blow a hole in me the size of a watermelon. And they didn't. And I found out something from that. Every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear. I had to walk through that wall of fear in order to get the good. Now, I don't know what your deal is. I'm just telling you my story. See? And I had to make it right. I had to pay that money back. I had to pay that $250,000 back plus interest. And I did not get an overwhelming damn good feeling. Okay? Anybody tells you they paid that back, well, they either ain't paid it back or they didn't pay much back. Because I didn't have nothing to show for it. Okay? Nothing. I don't mind coming out of a blackout in a brand new Mercedes sitting in front of AA meeting saying, you know, look what I bought, you know. But I had nothing to show for that $250,000, and I had to pay it back. I had to go get the money and make a deal and sign the deal with my life. God told me if I didn't pay it back, he'd kill me. Well, they're going to kill me if I don't. He's going to kill me if I do. So what the hell, you know. So I got the deal. It took me 14 years sober to pay that money back, and I paid it back. I took care of my family. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. They cleaned me up and they made me secretary of a meeting. I didn't know what was going on. I was just doing the next indicated thing. You know, my wife released me and went to Al-Anon, did all that stuff. And the kid released me, went to Alateen. And I'm just going to AA meetings. I had to trim my hair and trim my beard. They took me down to the Salvation Army and got me one of them suits, you know, pinstripe suits. You get a pair of pants with a suit with a lines going one direction, and shirt and tie that goes the other direction, and all, you know, but you're cool, you know, got a little hanky, get down to Army Surplus and get some green socks and green underwear, wear them 3 days, turn them inside out, wear them 3 days. You know. Explain that to me, see, because I travel light. And put me down there and railroaded me into the secretary of that meeting on Sunday down there at the Joanne Himalano Club. I had to hug people, and, you know, I didn't know what to do. I was just crazy. I wanted to drink all the time. I told people I wanted to drink all the time. And it didn't mean I was going to. I just wanted to, you know. And, you know, I stand around down there crazy in hell, did my inventory and done all that stuff. I never was, you know, crazy about the steps, but I wasn't afraid of them either. I did them. You know, did an immoral inventory and went up to Alaska and gave it to an Eskimo. Yeah. He shared some stuff with me, man. They do some sick crap up there. Man on that tundra and them long nights, man. He made me look like a saint, you know. I don't know. I just puked it out. I did a lot of speed, so I didn't have no secrets. I got them secrets. Not if you did any speed, you don't. Incriminated everybody, you know. I stand around down there, you know, I was about 3.5 years sober. I was, you know, just crazy, you know, nothing worse than done the steps, got a sponsor, everything's going fine, except, you know, you're just nuts, you know. I mean, you just got nothing going for you. You're just like about ready to implode, you know, just nuts, crazy. Everything's fine. Had a big AA car, parked it right out in front of the Alano Club so the newcomers could have hope, you know. Moving right along. Just crazy. 3.5 years sober, crazy. And I'm grateful for the old timers that watch people like that. I try to do that because if you don't watch them, they'll dissolve in AA. And I'm grateful that people watch for that second big bottom, sober. You know, and I'm sitting over there just dying inside. I'm bleeding out of every opening of my body, hemorrhaging. Because the book says, see, I'm in service and clean the cups and set up the chairs and I'm sober and I just had it tattooed on my forehead. This is it. This is, my wife's sponsor told her that I may never get any better than that. I had so many guns on me that if you'd have bumped into me, there'd have been a mushroom cloud. And the old timers watched me and just as I was about ready to just implode, why? They sent a newcomer over to me, and I didn't know it, and this guy showed up next to me. He'd been a secretary treasurer of a meeting the night before and asked for a treasurer's report, and he stood up and said he stole all the money and he wasn't paying it back. Standing next to me, he wasn't short enough to be a midget, tall enough to be a man. Weird-looking dude, had hair everywhere, you know, weirdo. And I said, what do you want? He said, will you be my sponsor? Oh, shit. Yeah, I just knew I'd really make God mad. I just knew it. And I looked at my sponsor. He's standing over in the corner grinning, you know, and I said, just a minute. I go over to my sponsor. I said, see that guy over there? He said, yeah. I said, well, he just asked me to be his sponsor. And my sponsor says, yeah, I know. I sent him over. I said, you go over there and tell him you'll be his sponsor and do what he says. And I thought, man, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. I'm going to be his sponsor, and I got to do what he says. I don't know what's going on. You know, I didn't want to argue with my sponsor, because if you argue with sponsors, they go crazy and just embarrass themselves. And so I go back over to that guy. I said, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? So I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln, you know. It's okay, you go out that door, I'll go out. No, he said, he grabbed me by the arm, you know, we got to go across the meeting hall over to the door, you know, and two guys I know over there by the door, they look at us, and weirdo says, this is my new sponsor. I said, don't tell people I'm your sponsor. The guys looked at us and said, boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow. I got him out in the lake, and man, took off down the street. First thing he said, how about this? And he started telling me this sick crap, man. Laid it out. He said, how about that? I said, well, how about this? I told him one or two. He said, you know what? You're sick. We're in trouble. I took him home, dropped him off, said, I'll be back to get him, you know, and went back to get him. Looked like he just stood on the porch. I don't know. What. Why'd you call me Harry? He said, I did. Hell, you did, huh? Get him in that old car, and he said, how about this one? Yeah, man, this one's pretty good, you know. It was, man. It was so bad. It was so bad that I had to lie to him about mine. Can't let him one-up you. And next day I picked him up. He said, I know you lied to me. I said, how do you know? He said, because it's physically impossible to do what you said you did. I tried it. I took him to hear Chuck Chamberlain sit right in the front row, man. We heard Chuck talk about God. Levitated the whole room, man. And after the meeting was over, we shook Chuck's hand, went out and got in a Lincoln. He looked at me and he said, we need a miracle. We're in trouble. I said, what are you thinking? He said, well, I mean, you know, like a burning bush or a party, you know, a sign. I'm thinking if I had some lighter fluid, I could torch ahead. Had an old 45 automatic in a glove box. I cranked around in it, put it upside his head. I said, I'll count to 10, you pray. If I don't have any floating resentments and decide to pop a cap on your ass, you've just done step 3. I counted real slow, and he hummed along there. I felt pretty good. Laid the old hammer back, put it in the glove box. He jumped out of my car, ran around there 2 or 3 times, yelled and screamed, and ran back in that old meeting, Anaheim Lano Club, and rat-finked on me. Showed my sponsor where I put the barrel of that gun right on the side of his head. Told my sponsor I made him do step 3 with a 45 in his head. My sponsor said, yeah, no, ain't he spiritual? I know that sounds sick, but you got to know some. There's a couple in here that'll vouch for that. I still occasionally have to put a gun in their head. A cannon, you know. But, you know, I mean, that's all we knew how to do. I mean, it's the kind of people who are pretty bent fenders, to tell you the truth. You know, sick, sick, sick. Wanted to drink all the time. Talked about wanting to drink. I'm one of those alcoholics that the desire to drink has never, ever left me. 25 years sober, 25 years sober. It ain't left me. You know, the animal's in the cage and the door ain't locked. See? I'm not obsessed with drink. There's a big difference between an obsession and a desire. I'm one of those kind of alcoholics. A lot of people want to say the main problem's in the mind. Don't take that out of text. See, it's a threefold disease, physical, mental, and spiritual. Without physical sobriety, you've got nothing. Nothing. And then you can get some mental sobriety and then spiritual sobriety. And physical sobriety, the phenomena of craving. I'm of the type of alcoholic that the phenomena of craving has never left me. My problem is not in the mind. I don't have no committee. I just got me. I know who I am. But I got a body that cries when it gets pain and screams like a wolf when it doesn't get what it wants. It craves all kinds of sugar and caffeine, things. Whip it up. So all them intellectuals that want to say the main problem's in the mind, I don't have no problem with that. But don't discount those of us that have a phenomenon of craving, because all who drink got drunk in the body, not the mind. And we got a lot of people wandering around Alcoholics Anonymous who are drunk in the body but ain't picked up a drink yet. So be careful. And I had to learn those things. Very important. I learned them by watching people die. Watching people die. And I didn't know what to do about it. I sponsored those guys. I did the best I could, and I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat in those meetings, and I tried to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to prison. I started going into institutions at early age, sobriety. Still do. Still do. Still going to prisons. I've been going into Chino Women's Institution for 18 years. And I was just in there, and they had four girls in there doing life for being accessory to a murder and a robbery. And they sobered up in that institution. And I'm going to give you a little profundity that they told me. Four girls shared their story in there last week. And their synopsis of the whole thing was, if you want something you've never had, you have to do something you've never done. Wow, isn't that cool? Huh? If you want something you've never had, you have to do something you've never done. From a convict serving life. And I didn't know those kind of things. I didn't know how to be a husband. I didn't know how to be a father. I didn't know how to do those things. I've had to learn all those things sober. And I was full of fear. And I had no idea. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know where I came from. I had so many costumes I could pose for a family portrait by myself. I'd wake up on Saturday morning and that was a bad day for me, and I'd think, well, who am I? Where am I going? And I'd have to get down there to that meeting, and I'd think, well, I'm from Texas, so I'm a cowboy. And I would put on my Levi's and my boots and my vest and my cowboy hat and get in front of that mirror and do a couple of shit howdies, and my wife would head for the phone, call her sponsor. I'd get my old pickup truck and I'd head for that meeting, and I'd get down there close to that meeting and I'd think, nah, I'm not a cowboy today. And I'd turn around and I'd come back home and I'd think, well, I'm a biker today. And I'd go and take my cowboy stuff off and I'd put my biker stuff on and get my bandana on, my leathers, and I'd get in front of the mirror and I'd think, you know, a couple of rib ups, I'm going to ride my Harley right down through that AA meeting up them old timers' ass, you know. I'd go out there and my wife would still be talking to her sponsor, and I'd get about halfway down there to that meeting, hit a light, and I'd think, no, I ain't a biker today. I'm a marshmallow. I'd turn around and come back home, park the bike, take off my leathers, and I'd think, well, I'm an intellectual today. And I'd go in there and get the dictionary out and look up four or five of them $50 words, and put my three-piece suit on and recite them words in front of that mirror, and my wife's still talking to her sponsor. I'd get my big AA car and head for the meeting. I'd be about a block from the meeting room. I'd forget them $50 words. You can't go down there in a three-piece suit. You ain't got none of them $50 words so you can zorrow those dumbasses. You know? I'd have to turn around, go back home, take off my suit, put on my jogging outfit. As on the way out, I'd kiss my wife goodbye. Her sponsor asked her one time, how many people live in that house? Said, we're getting her down to four. It's me and him, but he's getting her down to four, see? That's the way I was. I didn't know if I was Frank or Ernest or walking or riding a bicycle. I was crazy, see? And I get them newcomers and put them newcomers in the car, and away we go. Go to meetings everywhere. Ran all over everywhere with newcomers all the time. I've been working with newcomers ever since and ever still, see? And I didn't know what to do. I had to pay that money back, and I had to. There's some absolutes that I had to do, and they're just as absolute for me today as they were back then. See? I ain't hit nobody since May the 11th, 1976. I haven't hit anybody. Had to stop. See? I haven't written hot checks since May the 11th, 1976. And I haven't cheated on my wife since May the 11th, 76, nor has she cheated on me. Now, that's an amazing thing. See, because I didn't have any idea about trust. See, trust is something I knew nothing about. The curse of a thief is that he's untrustworthy to himself. He can't trust himself. And I'm a thief. And it dawned on me probably about 15 years sober that I hadn't cheated on my wife. Not because I'm a good guy, not because I didn't want to, not because I should have or could have, but because I didn't want to drink. You see, I knew from that 4 years of going in and out that if I did that, I'd drink, because I did that 4 years, and I knew that. And I woke up one morning, and it dawned on me I'd been faithful to my wife. And she trusted me. She trusted me. And it dawned on me that if my wife can trust me, then God must trust me. Now, isn't that a strange twist? Everybody says, trust God, clean house, and work with others. You know the benefit of that? When you trust God, clean house, and work with others, God trusts you because you're trustworthy. What a niche, huh? I had no idea. When that book says common sense will become uncommon sense, might be what they're talking about. And I'm going to stand here and tell you that every day's been a holiday and every meal's been a banquet and there ain't no pucky on the street out there, because I had me some character defects. I got me some character defects. I love my character defects. My character defects are me. See? If I got rid of them all, I'd be dead. Yeah. I just had to learn how to turn them into assets. See? I had to take all them character defects and turn them into assets. And man, I got me some character defects that have caused me some pain. Oh, man. I mean pain. Anybody tells you they ain't gone through no pain or nothing like that in sobriety, hey, don't ask them for a ride home. They'll lie to you again. Yeah. Because I've been through some stuff sober, and it was painful because I had to go through it sober. See, I've never done that. And I had to be stand up and be accounted for. I had to answer to my own actions, and I had to stand in front of people. People that have put me away, and I had to talk to them about me and not incriminate everybody around me. The old timers told me things when I'm being asked about my own actions, say, don't answer questions that ain't asked. Isn't that something? That's profound, ain't it? Because every time somebody asked me a question, I would incriminate everybody around me in order to justify my own actions. They told me, don't incriminate other people by justifying your own actions. Stand up and be accounted for. And you know, I've been able to do that. I've been able to get up in the morning and walk out on these streets and hold my head up. I don't have to cow down for nobody because I got no secrets. If you got no secrets, there is no gossip. Isn't that strange? It's a profound little thing. If you got no secrets, there is no gossip. See? And I'm sober as I am secret. There's nothing going on in my life. I can't stand here today and let you see. I got no secrets. See? And I'm trustworthy. An amazing thing. See, I had no idea that that was of even any value. See, of any value. I was able to work, get a job. I'm a union man. I worked for a union. And 42 years. I'm one of them kind of guys that needed a union steward and an arbitrator. Thank you very much. Somebody, no big deal. I worked for 42 years. And at 60 years old, I was able to retire. And that's fantastic. Because I had a credit union, savings account, all them lame things, you know? Them lame things, stupid things that people do, you know? 401K. Yeah. I couldn't believe that. I seen some guy driving a car down the street. I figured he stole it, you know? He didn't. He worked for it. I found that out. See? And so now I'm a kept man. Yeah. My wife gets up and go to work because she's younger than me. Every morning I get up in my beautiful home in Yorba Linda, and I go in and get her a cup of coffee, and I take it in there in the bathroom where she's putting on her makeup, and I tell her I love her. She gets all dolled up, and I tell her she's beautiful. 41 years we've been here. We fit butt to gut. We fit. Yeah. Yeah. Right. We still sleep together. We have great sex. Yeah. I love her. And I go in there and she gets all dressed up and I get her briefcase and her purse and I take it right out there and go out in the garage with her and she's got one of them 600 Mercedes convertibles and it's all cleaned up because I clean it up while she's getting ready. And she opens that door up and I put that briefcase and that little old purse in there and I tell her, bye, honey. And she backs right out there in Yorba Linda on that street and drives down the street and punches that button. And the door closes as I'm standing there waving by. Ain't that cool? Huh? I remember coming out of a flea bag motel. I've been in there all night screeching at the wall. Had an old pickup, went down the road crooked. And I come out of there needing a drink real bad on an August morning. And I slid up to a red light, and a half slid right out of that seat and up under the dash and back down. And it was like a spiritual experience, and I grabbed that thing, and I spun the top of it, and I turned it up, and as I did, I looked. There's a guy sitting next to me in a new Pontiac. Got a suit and tie on.
Got a little lunch pail there in the seat. He's clean. He's going to work. He's sitting at the red light next to me. And I'm taking a pull off a half because my life depends on it. And he's looking at me. I remember looking at him. What the hell are you looking at? I got to have this just to get to the next light. See? Now I'm that guy. Huh? I'm that guy. And my daughter's forgiven me. And she has a little granddaughter. See, I got a granddaughter. And forgiveness. Forgiveness. Took 8 years of sobriety before my daughter and I could sit next to each other and know that everything had been discussed that was supposed to be. 8 years. That's not too long to wait. Some time ago, when she had that little baby, her mama was able to go over there where she lives and be with her when she had that baby. And I don't mess with that part of her life. She lives in Italy and she's married to a young Italian man in their old, old, established family. And I don't mess with that. She comes here to see me. It's a good thing and it works and I don't mess with it. I leave it alone. But she comes to see me because she wants to. And when that baby was 8 months old, she got in an airplane and flew 19 hours with that 8-month-old baby to bring her to see her grandpa. And I went down there to that old LAX and in that international terminal. And like a stupid old man, I didn't know how to act like a grandpa. I stood in there and looked around. My wife was with me. She knows how. And pretty soon I seen that kid coming down that deal. And she's got that little baby. And that little baby's laughing and smiling. And I'm standing right behind all them flowers and balloon things. I didn't know, you know. And then she come up there and that little girl that watched me steal her money in that closet hand me that little 8-month-old baby. And that baby cooed and giggled and looked at me and pulled my beard and smiled. And I danced around like an old fool. Damn right. Because that baby was laughing. It wasn't crying. It wasn't afraid of Grandpa. And had no reason to. And I didn't care. Because I love her. And she loves me. She knows not how I treated her mama or grandma. And if I stay sober, she has no reason to fear me. And that's why I'm here. Just maybe the chain is broken. Maybe. Not too much, huh? And the other day, she heard they live in Milan, Italy, and she heard the soprano sing, "O Solo Mio." And that little girl called me up the other morning, and at 6 o'clock in the morning, because they're 9 hours ahead, she sang to me, "Grandpa." She said, "Pappy, listen to this." And she sang, "O Solo Mio." And my daughter said she had her eyes closed and her arms out, and she's singing to her grandpa. Hey, that ain't too bad. Considering in 1970, I stood in front of a judge, and a judge said to me in Nevada, "You live like an animal, you think like an animal, you defend yourself like an animal, you're going to die like an animal. It's just a matter of time." I never forget the ringing of that noise. I never, ever forget the ringing of those words. I never, ever forget where I come from or how important physical sobriety is. Physical sobriety. Now, I share with you one quick story because I told him 77 minutes. Where are we? Okay, good. I don't want to mess up the tape. I like stories. I'm just that kind of a guy. Kind of dumb, I guess. But there was a family who lived in Europe. A beautiful family. A mother and father and a little girl. And they loved each other with all the love that could be. And they were poor people. And they had a dream. Their dream was that they wanted to come to America someday. And in this particular little town where the great ocean liners came in and out where they lived, there was a great ocean liner that sailed in there occasionally. And they wanted to go on that ocean liner. And their dream was that maybe someday they could come to America. And so they made a pact among themselves. They would work very hard and they would put their money together. And maybe there would come a time that they could buy passage on this great ocean liner. And there came that day, because they did. They worked very hard and saved their money. And the day that they could buy passage on that great ocean liner, and their dream was coming true, they packed everything they had and they went down, bought their ticket, and got in the room and opened the porthole, and they were looking out and they were excited and they loved each other with an abundance and they had great enthusiasm. And as the great ocean liner sailed away, well, they were happy. And they stayed in that room like 4 days. And all they could talk about what it was going to be like when they got to America and the dream came true and all the things were great. And 4 days went by, and pretty soon, since the only thing that they had left money they could buy was crackers and cheese, that's all they'd eaten for 4 days. And after 4 days, the little girl told her daddy, said, "Daddy, Daddy, I'm hungry. I got to have something else. I can't stand this crackers and cheese." And daddy, being a good daddy, reached in his pocket and pulled out some change and said, "Here, baby, go up to the galley and buy yourself an ice cream." And the little girl left the room and she went away, and she was gone for an hour, and her mother and father had no idea what was going on. They couldn't figure out what was happening. They were worried sick, and they sat in that room, and pretty soon there was a knock at the door, and they opened the door, and there was a little girl. She had a smile on her face and a sparkle in her eye. And the father said, "Where have you been? We've been worried sick. It'd take an hour to go up to the galley." She said, "Oh, no, no, Daddy." He said, "I went up to the galley, and I had steak, and I have potatoes, and I had two ice creams." And the dad said, "You can have steak and potato and two ice creams for a nickel." And she said, "No, Daddy, the food's free. It comes with the ticket." Let me tell you something, folks. That is not a story about love, because there was an abundance of love. That is a story about ignorance. Ignorance. And teachers. Because those people were ignorant and they knew nothing else. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was ignorant. I knew nothing else. Be careful of your teachers, because there's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that'll settle for crackers and cheese. I came here with crackers and cheese, baby. I want the whole enchilada. I went over there tonight and had barbecued ribs, man, and pudding. I remember when me and Ed, we ate down some Chinese place, had all the rice you could eat. See? I want the whole enchilada. Don't settle for anything less. And be careful of your teachers. Be careful of your teachers. You earned it. And God's free. He comes with the ticket. Thank you.